From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. One of the largest Latino street gangs in Los Angeles has been accused of targeting blacks just because of race. Federal prosecutors say the Florencia 13 gang, also known as F-13, has deliberately shot and killed blacks, and some of the victims were singled out even if they had no gang affiliation. Authorities say it was an effort to push blacks out of the Florence Firestone neighborhood near Watts. Some have even raised concerns about a potential race war. Joining me now to talk about a major investigation into the Florencia 13 gang is Los Angeles County Sheriff Lee Baca. Sheriff Baca, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. And as you've indicated, there is an extensive amount of effort by the Sheriff's Department, the U.S. Attorney's Office, members of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the FBI, and the Sheriff, and then quite frankly, even the LAPD. And the whole thing is based on a violent gang that is basically in a drug war with another gang. And we've had a number of murders over the years. And at the same time, when the Florencia gang has dispatched their people, their shooters, to go out and shoot rival gang members, and they can't find rival gang members, then they've been alerted to just shoot any African-American they see.
Well, Sheriff Baca, we have a couple more people with us. NPR's Mondalit Del Barco, she has been covering the Florencia 13 extensively, spoken with some of the gang members. We've also got Earl Afari Hutchinson, L.A.-based author of The Latino Challenge to Black America. Guys, thanks for coming on. We're going to talk more with you in a second, but Sheriff, why don't you tell me about Operation Joker's Wild?
Simply, in order to deal with a violent gang, you have to have a lot of resources. And as I identified earlier, those resources are all working in a team effort. A lot of our energy is spent in surveilling gangs, monitoring their phone conversations. And it was in monitoring one of the conversations that we were able to detect this more blatant racist effort by Florencia 13.
Now, how many of these indictments are racially motivated, in your opinion?
Well, you would have to talk to U.S. Attorney particularly about that, but there is at least one, and that's all you need. You see, the issue is not volume. It's the fact that in a particular incident, there was an instruction by a shot caller to a field shooter to shoot any black once the field shooter couldn't locate a rival black gang member. That's enough right there, and that leads to us to be very, very wary of this. And there's been other examples with Wilmington area in the past where African-Americans were targeted by Latino gangs because of their being an African-American. That's enough for me.
Mondalit, you have been down to the Florence Firestone area. What's the neighborhood like? How's it evolved over the past couple decades?
Well, Farai, this is a neighborhood in South L.A., like you said, not that far from Watts. And at one time, this area was mostly African-American, but now it's primarily Latino. The story I heard from investigators is that Florencia 13, Florencia being Spanish for Florence, of course, began in the early 1950s as a turf gang that rumbled with its rivals. But now there are perhaps 2,000 members or associates in at least 30 cliques. The U.S. Attorney's Office tells me that over the years, Florencia got more and more involved in criminal activity. And like a lot of street gangs in L.A., a lot of the shots are called by members who are locked up in California prisons. They supposedly instruct the so-called soldiers in the streets to do what they call putting in work or doing their dirty work. And in the hierarchy of Florencia 13, I'm told that some of the members in prison are also part of La M, the Mexican Mafia, another prison gang. According to the investigators, there was one member of this gang who is now in federal prison who specifically gave the orders to have Florencia gang members stop fighting their Latino rivals and start attacking their black rivals instead.
You've interviewed some of the F-13 gang members in the neighborhood. Tell me about one young man you've spoken with and what he has to say about the racial tensions between gangs.
Yeah, well, after the leaders of Florencia were rounded up, I went to the heart of this neighborhood and I met up with a 13-year-old. Now, for his protection, I'm only going to use his street name, Wacko.
My friends are black, too, and we close, too. We like blood. For me, it's all the same color for me. I don't care what color they are, as long as they're my friends, it's all cool with me, as long as they don't betray me.
What about the other guys in your clique? Are they cool with black people?
Yeah, they're cool with black people, too. We don't got nothing against them.
Well, that sounds like a complete contrast to what we've heard.
That's right. Well, it goes to show that whatever thoughts this little kid has personally at home or in school among people he knows, he still faces some of the bigger racial tensions in the neighborhood. And he talked about some of the attitudes he's encountered, too.
Every time when they see us, like, they try to dog us.
Who does?
The black people.
What do they say?
And they just look at us like damn, we just, I keep on walking. I don't say anything to them because I know black people, too. And I ain't no racist guy, too.
Wacko told me that some of the guys in Florencia, his friends, are also black. And it's really interesting to note that some of the drug customers or dealers that Florencia 13 is alleged to have controlled also were African American.
Earl, you've written this book, The Latino Challenge to Black America. When you hear Mondalit's reporting, what is the cut that you're hearing on this situation from the African-American community, particularly since you run a political forum that is based here in Los Angeles? What are you hearing?
Well, it's a mixed bag. On the one hand, we have a number of African-Americans that have very good relations. I'm talking about community leaders, some of the civil rights activists, and some of those that are actually on the ground working on a day-to-day basis with black-Latino relations. In our forums, we've had a number of forums on black-Latino relations where we brought people together, hashed out some of the problems, and actually have had some coalition efforts around certain issues, gang violence, issues involving deterioration in some of the communities. So there has been a willingness to work together. On the ground, listening to the young man, there's hope there. Because what it shows is when people are left, especially young people, to their own devices, they can actually get along. Unfortunately, what happens, things are manipulated from the outside by other vested interests. Obviously, in this case, we have the gangs, we have the prison direction that's coming from some of these gangs. But I think overall, the mood is this. If the leadership, and this is critically important, can step up to the plate when sensitive issues come up, problems come up, even flashpoint problems come up, I think we can get a handle on it. And we've shown that time and time again in issues particularly involving violence and attacks in our community.
Sheriff Baca, when you hear Earl talk about this situation, there's got to be a delicate balance between the aggressive prosecution and realizing that L.A. can be a racial tinderbox. Do you take that into account as you're proceeding?
You have several subcultures within the races. First of all, gang members, whether they're black or Latino, don't speak for an entire community. They're criminals to a certain extent, especially those that carry the guns and do the drug dealing and do the shooting, and it goes mostly within the race. And then yet when it crosses over, as we've seen with Florencia as an example, it's also the South Sider gang members in jails. The county jail suffered a couple years ago some extensive rioting where Latinos, at the instruction of Mexican mafia in the prisons, were attacking randomly any black inmate. And I think that we have to separate the reality that those who are lost to the success path, and that's usually a gang member, and that's why I'm working diligently to do intervention work to keep kids out of gangs, black or Latino, that really the gang members are not going to dictate race relations. That's really where those of us who have things that are more important than committing crimes, you know, standard community leader is not a criminal, and thus we have to take away the conversation and put it right where it belongs, and that is young people in gangs are dangerous. They do dangerous things, and they're insensitive to race relations at times. And when they have a gun in their hand, they're going to kill an innocent person.
Mondalit, a Los Angeles Times article last year about this story had a headline that read, "Gang Rivalry Grows into Race War." From your coverage of the story, what do you think about that very loaded term of race war?
Well, like you said, it is a loaded term. And just like the investigator from the U.S. Attorney's Office that I spoke to, I am also very, very cautious about calling this situation a race war. It seems like really inflammatory language. And in fact, the investigator, Peter Hernandez, was more careful to say that specific instructions from state prison were given to have the members try to cleanse the neighborhood of its rivals. Some of them are black, like the East Coast Crips, and others are Latino.
Earl, what about this question? Is race war is a term that's often been applied to white supremacists or used by white supremacists. Does it apply in this case?
Well, I think it doesn't. And in this sense, when you really look at the violence, between African Americans and Latinos. It's really not between African Americans and Latinos. At the street level, the overwhelming majority of crimes, whether we're talking about murders, assaults, or whatever, it's black on black, Latino on Latino. That hasn't changed. The problem is when there's one crossover, an attack by a Latino on a black on Latino, it's blown up. It's sensational. It makes news, just like when a white attacks a black. But that's not the norm. So that's why I go back to what I said before. Even though, yes, there is obviously racial tensions, racial problems, I think to say a race war really, really does disservice to what's happening.
Sheriff Baca, what do you see ahead in this whole investigation?
Well, I think what's happening is that right now I'm working on, with the county and the city of Los Angeles, a gang emergency operations center where we can coordinate all the things that go on regarding gangs. Only about 2% are involved with the heavy-duty gun shooting and killings and the things that we all are appalled by. What we need now is to realize that young people need jobs, young people need to stay in school, young people need to have opportunities. That's why I have three athletic centers and activity centers for youth, and one in Compton, one in the Vermont area, and one in Florence Firestone. And police have to reform to the degree that we're involved with the intervention piece, not just the enforcement piece. We're never going to arrest our way out of this gang problem. We need a paradigm shift.
Well, thank you guys for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Los Angeles County Sheriff Lee Baca, also NPR's Mandalit Del Barco, and Earl Ofari Hutchinson, author of The Latino Challenge to Black America. Those two join me here at our NPR West studios. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Today we continue our month-long series called Great Expectations, tracking people who've succeeded against the odds and sometimes against other folks' perceptions. You might know the term hater. It's a word for people who just aren't happy when others succeed. You know how it is. You want to go to grad school, but your family, your community isn't having it. And just who do you think you are anyway? That's our question. What happens when you raise your personal expectations, but those around you resent that you aren't settling for less? We've got some folks to help us talk about that clash. Sokolin Finney is a teacher at Harbor Teacher Preparation Academy in Wilmington, California. She has won the Milliken National Educator Award for Excellence. Carolyn Murray is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside, and reporter Aisha Walker is a reporter for Youth Radio. Her commentaries about growing up in Richmond, California have aired on NPR. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello.
So, Aisha, let me start with you. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up, what it's like, and when you were in high school, what did your classmates want to be when they got older?
I stay in Richmond, California, and in my city, it's pretty, it's a working class city. I mean, I'm speaking on the inner city, and while in high school, you had a mixed group of people, a lot of white and Asians, and like you had your people who grew up in the upper class neighborhoods or middle class neighborhoods who wanted to go off and, you know, go to school, go to college after high school. And then you had like the people who I hung around, which were majority blacks who weren't really thinking about college. I know I wasn't thinking about college in high school, and didn't really work towards graduating high school, really.
What do you mean by that? How did you come up with that template for what you expected from yourself?
I had to find resources outside of my city. I had to surround myself with a whole bunch of people who wanted to be successful in life. And that meant that I had to kind of move myself away from the people who I grew up with in a way.
Did they consider you stuck up, a traitor, too good, you know, not black enough? How did that all play out in how people saw you?
No, I don't think my friends or my family members see me as too good, but we don't really see eye to eye on the things that we're interested in. Like, I find myself telling my friends that, hey, I have to work in the morning. I have three jobs and I'm trying to go to school and I can't go out and party with you guys. And they'll get mad at me, but I just have to, you know, tell them, hey, you know, I have to communicate with them that I'm doing different things now.
Carolyn and Sakhalin, let me turn to both of you. You're educators, and I'm going to ask each of you, Sakhalin first, why'd you go into teaching?
I went into teaching because I enjoyed tutoring. I've always helped other people in school. When I was in middle school, I was back at my elementary school. When I was in high school, I helped my friends. In college, I tutored. When I was working as an engineer, I was being paid to tutor. As I started to volunteer in my son's elementary school classroom, I realized that it was much more fun, much more enjoyable. And to see a kid's eyes light up when they get it makes all the difference. So it was much more enjoyable, and I decided that it would also give me the same schedule as my son. So I decided I'd switch for even if it's just until he graduates.
Now, you've achieved incredible success in the classroom. How did your friends and family treat you growing up? I mean, was it the kind of thing where you were groomed for success from day one? Like, okay, you've got to do this. You've got to go out. You've got to achieve. Or was there a lack of expectation? Where do you fall on that spectrum?
In my immediate family, we were always taught that no matter what we choose to do, we were expected to do our best. We represented my mother and father. They talked about how difficult it was for them to get to their level. And we were expected to try hard. No matter how hard it was, you were expected to never give up. So we're very determined bunch of kids. We don't always make the right decision along the way. I haven't always made the right, but we're very, very determined in what we do. Outside of my personal immediate family, there have been people along the way that have said, you already have one degree, why get two? Or don't you have enough? I think the hardest part about teaching was when I made the switch, going from engineering to teaching, a lot of people that I knew thought I was crazy. Why would you make that switch and told me I would never be happy? Because I was such a go-getter at that time.
Carolyn, before I get to your how you got into teaching, what does it say, what kind of challenges do people face if either you're coming from a background where you're a pioneer, you are moving forward into paths that other people haven't taken educationally or financially, and maybe you face resistance, even passive resistance. How should people deal with that?
Well, it's a very difficult situation to deal with, but people can overcome it. I know I personally overcame it. For instance, when I went off to graduate school, my godmother was very concerned about me, and she was saying, but this is like the late 60s, early 70s, and she said to me, she said, you know, when you went to college, we thought, well, that's nice, but now graduate school, you know, you really need to get out, you need to get a job, you need to get seniority on a job, you don't need to be playing around in school. And I was thinking to myself, well, I'm earning a PhD from the University of Michigan, one of the most distinguished schools in the country. But my family didn't see it that way. And I know a lot of black families do see it that way, but mine didn't. And the reason why they didn't is because we lived in a community where most people went to the automobile factories and they worked and they got seniority and they owned their own homes and they raised their families. So I was going against the grain, and so I was kind of seen as doing something that wasn't going to pay off. But that was realistic for that particular period of time. And why that was realistic, I had worked at the post office, and working there, I interacted with men and women who had master's degrees. I also interacted with people who were porters on trains, who had gone to law school, but they couldn't get jobs prior to the 1970s in the occupations that they had been trained for. So my family thought that the same thing would happen to me, that I was going to be frustrated because I would have all this education and I wouldn't be able to use this education. But a new door had opened. Even though it had only slightly opened, it had opened. And so I was taking advantage of it, but because I was a pioneer, I was seen as doing something that wasn't going to be beneficial for me in the long run. And I think part of the way you overcome it, part of it is personality. I had the kind of personality, and I was so motivated that I could go against the grain. A lot of people aren't, and that kind of pull from the family or the community often results in them not succeeding. But you really do have to just continue in spite of the resistance. And then the other thing is to have a good mentor. If a person has a mentor, someone to let them know the ins and outs of the road that they're traveling, it makes it a lot easier.
Well, in case you're just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're talking about what happens when you have high ambitions and other people may or may not share that. It's part of our series called Great Expectations. We were just hearing from Carolyn Murray, a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. We also have Sacalyn Finney, a teacher at Harbor Teacher Preparation Academy in Wilmington, California. She won recently the Milken National Educator Award for Excellence. And we've also got Aisha Walker, a reporter for Youth Radio based in Northern California. Aisha, you heard Carolyn just talking about some generational issues, that because we as African Americans didn't always have that way to move up the ladder, that some people may have just been trying to be protective when they said, you know what, just don't do this, don't do that. What about you? Generationally, did you feel like there was a perception coming from Richmond, which I know pretty well, having lived in Northern California? There's a lot of toxins because of the oil refineries. There's definitely issues that go on there. Did people feel like this is a new day we can achieve, or was there not that sense?
I don't feel like, sometimes I feel like there is no hope for my city because of all the things that are going on. You know, youngsters are out there killing each other. Youngsters are trying to make fast money, selling drugs, and it just seems like there's no hope. But when I was younger, in elementary school, I'll say one thing. Every single last one of my teachers were Black, and therefore that made me, you know, it gave me a sense of who I was as an African-American or an American-African. And I learned my culture, and I learned a lot more. And then there was that shift when I got to junior high school, and I no longer had solely black teachers, and there was a disconnection there. And I just feel like the schools have a lot to do with, you know, helping us prepare towards revolution.
You did a recent commentary and talked about how your mom likened living in Richmond to living in a bucket of crabs. You just talked about the streets, and you've also talked about how your best friend and cousin got shot, luckily survived. What's this whole bucket of crabs that your mom was talking about?
Well, my mom, she's always been one to push me towards success, and I owe a lot to that. I owe all of it to her, or most of it to her. And she always told me that the people around me are going to pull me down no matter how hard I try to move myself up. And I'm trying to get out of this bucket, and then I have, like, you know, my cousins, I have my friends, I have my family, and people that I meet on a day-to-day basis in my city pulling me down with influence.
Sacalyn, when you face a student who feels like they're in that bucket of crabs, what kind of pep talk do you give?
I talk to them about their goals, coming to talk to us, giving them other mentors. We have programs, and I have friends that are other African-American teachers where we take on students and personally make it our goal to get them to graduation. And so if their home environment or their friend's environment do not encourage them to graduate, then we do. And we make it a point that we go so far as to make sure they do homework with us. If we need to call them and wake them up in the morning, we get them a partner to call. We talk to them and tell them that any problem they have, they can call us. We give them our cell phone numbers, our home phone numbers for the kids that have the most problems. And we do everything we can, including talking to the parents about helping them and being more positive in their lives. And then we ultimately tell them that when it's all said and done, it's just them. It's just their choice. And we need them to be strong enough to say, I don't want to quit. I want to do this. And if everybody says I can't, Miss Finney says I can't, or Miss Niecy says I can't, and they believe in me. And we hang in there with them. We still have students that call us. They're in college now, or they're in the military now, or they write us or whatever. But sometimes if their immediate family can't do it, then we become their surrogate family. And that's the only way sometimes that we make it.
Carolyn, you talked about finding a mentor. How do you go about that, maybe as you get older? How do you find that person who's also going to lift you up?
Well, first of all, you try to identify people who have common interests to your interests, who've already been a trailblazer in that area. Now, sometimes they're not trailblazers in that area. They may be in an area that's closely related, but you attempt to identify that person or persons. Often mentors will choose you. They will choose you because they see something in you. And that's the best way to get a mentor, one who sees something in you, and they want to groom whatever that is in you. But sometimes you have to search out a mentor, and you have to let them know how motivated you are and what you have to offer. And so people should take the time to find people who have interests that are similar, who've already succeeded, or who have done things that are outstanding in a certain area.
Aisha, do you have a mentor, and do you mentor anyone else?
excuse me. I do have a mentor. I have several. And, yes, I find myself having to talk to my people around me, to students and my cousins. And I know there are a lot of boys that don't have fathers and who need role models. And I'll say that a lot of successful people who grow up in Richmond, they move up and then they move out. So we don't have anyone to really look up to, opposed to the people who are out in the streets.
Sakalin, what about that issue of gender? There's a lot of, we here at the show talk a lot about the issues of Black girls and Black women. There's some specific things, Black boys and Black men. You're obviously a woman. How do you deal with some of the issues that your male students might face?
We actually seek out as many Black males as we can find as a friend to just help us. A lot of boys hang out in my room. I seem to do well with them. But I definitely, if there are certain points, I will call my friends. I will call my brother and say, talk to this kid, or call my father or someone. And if the kid trusts me enough, they'll talk to whoever we have. But it's a really, really serious need because we do not have enough males in the school. And our Black boys really need someone there to act like someone to say, well, this is how I should act in this situation as a man. When they talk to me, it's, they say a lot of times it's like talking to their mother, but they need a male to say, this is like talking to my father. So we seek out as many people as we can find to bring them in.
Well, I want to thank you guys for your wisdom. Sakalin, Carolyn, Aisha, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sakalin Finney is a teacher at Harbor Teacher Preparation Academy in Wilmington, California. She won the Milken National Educator Award for Excellence. She was here at our NPR West studios. Carolyn Murray is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. And Aisha Walker is a reporter for Youth Radio. She's contributed commentaries to NPR about growing up in Richmond and joined us from Youth Radio studios in Oakland, California. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's time again for a look at sports with our very own Tony Cox. And Tony, it seems like baseball news is year-round now.
It is, Farai, but this year's topic is hotter than ever. The steroid scandal is, well, on steroids, it seems, and keeps getting bigger. That's topic number one on today's Bloggers Roundtable. Joining us are Dee Will, who writes for the blog Sports on My Mind, Justin Grant posts for Alpha Sports blog, he also writes for Reuters, and Greg Lee is online sports editor for the Boston Globe. So hello, everybody. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Let's start with the Rocket. Here's some quick background for people who may not know what's going on. Roger Clemens, of course, widely considered the greatest pitcher of this era. And when his name showed up on former Senator George Mitchell's recent report on steroid use in baseball, Clemens didn't just deny that he had ever used performance-enhancing drugs. He got downright indignant about it. Then Clemens secretly recorded a phone conversation with his accuser, Brian McNamee, and played it at a press conference this week. Now, McNamee, of course, is Clemens's former trainer and claims to have injected the 7-time Cy Young Award winner with anabolic steroids and human growth hormones over a 3-year period beginning in about 1998. So here's a bit of a very ambiguous recorded telephone conversation that Clemens had with McNamee. The voice you're going to hear is McNamee.
I never thought it was right, but I thought that I had no other choice, put it that way. And I think that when I spoke to you guys, that I laid that out there. And then I was sick. I was in the hospital. Told to Kenny, I was throwing up. I was, that was me. I could deal with that. You know, I could deal with that. But, you know, whatever you want to do, just let me know what you want me to do.
So here's the very latest thing. The congressional committee that was supposed to look into this matter next week has now postponed that hearing to next month. And Clemens is expected to be the star witness. So there's all the background, D. Will. What do you make of the way Clemens is handling all of this?
I think Roger Clemens is actually taking the Lance Armstrong approach. If people remember, when Lance Armstrong, the cyclist, was accused of using steroids, he went on the attack against his accusers, and he pulled out all the stops, used the press, used lawyers, et cetera, et cetera. Clemens, a fellow Texan, is doing the same thing. Other athletes have bowed to the pressure and have said, yes, I used, or kind of have fallen silent. Clemens, on the other hand, has taken an aggressive approach. Does that mean he's guilty, innocent? It means neither. It just means that's the approach he's taking.
How do you see it, Justin?
Well, I listened to the recording that he played at that press conference the other day, and to me it was a strange tactic that him and his lawyers employed there, and to me it made him seem more guilty. If I stood accused of the things that McNamee accused me of using the steroids over that period of time, and he asked me, what do you want me to do? It's obvious what I want you to do. I want you to admit to the world that you're lying, and that you never injected me with steroids. To me, that recording made Roger Clemens look more guilty.
Well, let me ask Greg this then. How does this play out, or how do you think it will play out coming up to the congressional hearings where it looks like Clemens is now going to be expected to testify under oath?
Well, I think it's what's going to end up happening is, you know, like with the Lance, I agree with the Lance Armstrong, you know, with. He had the resources to pay for lawyers and pay for PR and do what the attack that Clemens is doing. I think Clemens at the congressional hearings will just, you know, hear, if they ask the direct question, he has to answer, did he do it? And that's going to be something that he's going to say, he probably would say no. I mean, I think he would. I mean, because he would say he didn't do it. Someone may have put it inside of him, but technically he would say, I didn't do it myself.
Well, is that the Barry Bonds defense?
It could be the Barry Bonds. It definitely could be the Barry Bonds defense. I just think, you know, he's going to, you know, with Roger, he has the resources. Unlike Marion Jones, who didn't have the financial resources to defend, like, you know, like what Lance Armstrong has done and what Roger has done so far, I think that's what's going to happen.
All right. Okay, let's move on. Golf, anyone? Last Friday, Golf Channel anchor Kelly Tillman made a comment that has some people up in arms. Now, during the telecast of the PGA Tour's opening event, she was bantering with co-host Nick Faldo about Tiger Woods and his competition. Here's a bit of what they said.
To take Tiger on, well, yeah, maybe they should just gang up for a while until...
Lynch him in the back alley.
Yeah, that's right. And then...
So, in a statement that was released on Monday, Tillman said that she used some poorly chosen words and that she has apologized directly to Woods. Now, it looked like that might be the end of it until Al Sharpton, among others, called for her head. Now, the Golf Channel responded by suspending her for 2 weeks. So what do you make of this, Greg?
I just think that it's just one of those unfortunate instances that happened. I look at it this way. I look at it that what, and I'm not looking at the statement. I'm looking at what are the, you know, the background in terms of the management system, management there. Is there any diversity there? Is there any true sense of, you know, people of color in the management decision making there? Because this always happens. Unfortunately, you know, with Don Imus and that sort. I always look at the background of the station, the background of the company, of things that have happened of this sort. And if it's any reflection of the game of golf, I'm kind of afraid for what I'm going to get, what type of answer I would get from that.
What do you say, D. Will?
I feel that it's more than an unfortunate incident and more than just a slip of the tongue or she misspoke. I can off the top of my head think of 10 different things to say than use the word lynch. Mm-hmm. If Tiger Woods were Jewish, mm-hmm. would she say, take him in a back alley and put him in a gas chamber? Okay, and what would the reaction to that be? I don't have any ill feelings towards this woman. Other than that, it is the language of privilege, and I do not have any respect for someone who uses that language.
So, Justin, if she made a mistake, how big a mistake do you think it is, and what punishment, if any, do you think is appropriate in this case?
Well, I've listened to that clip over and over again, and it was a quick statement by the lady there. But I tend to agree with D. Will. There's certain buzzwords in the English language within the media that nothing good can come from you using them. Nappy-headed, Hitler, lynching. It was a poor, poor choice of words, especially for somebody that's an anchor. But I think that in this instance, the suspension is it's a good enough punishment. I really don't believe that she was trying to be malicious. She was foolish. But I'm fine with the suspension.
All right, let's move on. Another NFL playoff weekend looms ahead, and Jessica Simpson is still getting plenty of press because of her thing with Dallas quarterback Tony Romo. But nonetheless, we've got the New York Giants at Dallas, Jacksonville meeting New England, Seattle at Green Bay, and San Diego at Indianapolis. So what's the most intriguing matchup here, do you think, Greg, and what's the do-not-miss game?
Well, I still think it's going to be the Jaguars and the Patriots. I just think it's going to be very interesting to see how the Jaguars, with their physical type of offense, were able to run the ball with their two-headed monster of Jones, Drew, and Taylor, and try to keep the Patriots' offense and potent offense off the field, which will be a tough task. And I think a lot of people would say the Patriots were romping them, but I still like to see, you know, the Jaguars are a tough team that came off, you know, winning, beating Pittsburgh twice in Pittsburgh, and I think that they are. This is going to be an interesting test for the undefeated Patriots.
Well, I think you're right, but I think another very interesting test is going to be the Giants at Dallas. What do you say, Justin?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's funny to me. Headed into last year, you look at last season, Peyton Manning, all the pressure was on him. Now it's all on his little brother with Peyton Manning finally having won his championship. And I think the big question heading into this game is which Eli Manning is going to show up. He's put up 35 points against Dallas in the season opener. He put up 35 against Bill Belichick. Last week he was 20 for 27 with no turnovers against the Tampa Bay Bucks. Can Eli stand up to the pressure and put up those type of numbers going into this playoff game? If he can, I think the Giants definitely have a shot. Dallas is coming into this playoff game. They're not really playing all that well. The Giants are on a roll. They have a lot of confidence. Let's see what happens.
Well, you know, D. Will, you're in Vermont. They don't have a professional football team in that state, but you're close enough to Boston to perhaps root for the Patriots. But what do you do when you're in a state where you don't have a team? How do you find one to root for?
Well, let's see. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and our family's had season tickets to Redskins games for 25 years. So I'm a diehard Redskins fan. I do appreciate what the Patriots are doing, having gone undefeated in the regular season. And I agree with Justin and Greg about both of those games. And actually, I find all four games very intriguing because all the teams that are playing each other are connected in some form or fashion, whether it be San Diego and Indianapolis and San Diego's complete lack of fear of Indianapolis, the Mike Holmgren tie to Green Bay, and the connections that were made by Justin and Greg, what they spoke of. And so all four of these games are can't-miss games in my estimation.
All right, let's close with this. We've got a couple of minutes. The BCS. It takes hits every year from fans who don't like the outcome of the national championship bowl selections. This year, no different. Even if you're an LSU fan, you might not think that the shellacking of Ohio State in the title game was what you would call good football to watch. And now there's talk of a playoff, possibly. And here's the thing. It's being pushed by folks who used to oppose a playoff in college football. What's going on here, Greg?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to complain because I am a Louisianian, so I'm not going to complain about LSU winning a national title. But it's so funny that the University of Georgia president, who was against it, now became a victim of not being his team, the University of Georgia, not being placed in a national title game. But the bottom line was with Georgia, they didn't even win their own division, so they didn't deserve to be in a national title game. With that being said, Ohio State, the Big Ten, they do not want to have a playoff system because it works perfectly for them. They have a pretty weak conference that they can you'll go undefeated or lose one game and get to go to a national title game every year and take their chances going in the game. So they didn't want the system to change because look, Ohio State made it a national title game the last 2 years, regardless of what the outcome is. But for a lot of other conferences such as USC got screwed out, I think, this year. I think they could have played LSU, and I think it would have been a great game. Look, Illinois shouldn't even have been in the Rose Bowl. It should have been Missouri in that game, or Georgia, for that matter, but tradition won out.
We have less than a minute. Let me ask you, Justin, do you think this is ever likely to happen, a playoff?
I'm on the fence. I can't call it. The thing that will lose out here if they do put a playoff system in place is what happens to the intrigue of the regular season. That's the beauty of the regular season in college football. Theoretically, the national championship is on the line every week because if you lose, it can seriously cripple your chances at getting into that championship game. So the regular season would lose out, the intrigue of it. But we all know that championships should be decided on the field of play, and a playoff system would definitely be the most suitable way to do that.
Let me give D. Will 10 seconds to say, do you think a playoff is likely to happen, yes or no?
I'm not really sure. As long as the Big Ten and the Pac-10 hold sway with the Rose Bowl, it's going to be difficult to institute a playoff system. However, if enough large conferences, Big 12, SEC, ACC, Big East, do want to if they can put that pressure on, there will be one.
All
but right.
Right
now, I don't think so.
We got to stop right there. Gentlemen, thank you very much. You can find Justin Grant's post at Alpha Sports Blog. D. Wilt writes for the blog Sports on My Mind. And Greg Lee is online sports editor for the Boston Globe.
Thank you, Tony.
Take care. Take care.
That was NPR's Tony Cox. It is Thursday, the day we read from your letters, but I never go it alone. Here with me now to help thumb through the mail is producer Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher.
Hey, Farah.
So what do you got?
On Tuesday's Bloggers Roundtable, you discussed the New Hampshire primaries. All of your guests weighed in on the winners and the losers. Here's LaShawn Barber's take on the results.
Well, to tell the truth, I haven't been following the day-to-day political drama. I blog about other things these days, but I get the overall picture. Obama has sort of raced out in front of Hillary, although he didn't win in New Hampshire. Is that right?
A listener named Balti Mama, who checks us out on member station WYPR in Baltimore, cast her own vote on LaShawn. I hope that you don't invite LaShawn Barber back on your show. You asked her about the New Hampshire primary, and she didn't even know who'd won it. It's unbelievable that anyone could not know who'd won. It's even more unbelievable that someone going on a national news program would not even have a basic grasp of at least a headline of the biggest news story in the country.
And here's another letter from Baltimore. It's from Ernie Barnes, who wrote to check us on our tribute to the late rock and soul guitarist Ike Turner. Ike died last month. Ernie writes, on your Ike Turner Remembrance broadcast, you stated that John Fogerty wrote Proud Mary and Creedence Clearwater Revival covered it. That sounded kind of absurd to the many NPR listeners who know that Creedence was Fogerty's band, and in 69, they were the first to record it. I hope that you, as an African-American journalist, give a seamless and, if possible, flawless presentation of whatever news or info you're presenting. Well, Ernie, thank you for the letter. I think this might be a simple misunderstanding. I did say the song was Fogerty's because he is the one credited with writing it. Recording credits are often very specific about who is and who is not responsible for penning a tune, and it's not uncommon for one or two band members to write a song that the entire group performs. So I went on to say that Proud Mary was recorded by Creedence Clearwater Revival and that it has been covered dozens, if not hundreds, of times.
Finally, we got this letter from Teresa Roberson in Fort Worth, Texas. She wrote about your interview for I with Felicia Pearson, an actress on the hit TV series The Wire. Teresa was upset with how you two touched on the details of Felicia's real-life drama. Teresa writes, I heard you touch ever so tentatively on the subject of Miss Pearson's going to prison. In the introduction of your guest, you said, in part, that Miss Pearson was even set up for killing a woman. Then you went on to interview your guest. When you were speaking with Miss Pearson and broached the fact that she was in prison for murder, I swear I heard Miss Pearson interject in self-defense, pretty pointedly. Then you repeated, in self-defense, which seemed to be in agreement with her statement. But on the version on the website, all I hear is you saying, in self-defense, and not Miss Pearson's interrupted defense at all. Am I nuts? Did I imagine that part? Really, I did not expect you to necessarily give her a tongue-lashing in the brief interview you conducted, but I am sorry you handled her with such kid gloves.
Thanks for your letter, Teresa. In my interview with Felicia Pearson, I did say once that she went to jail for killing someone in self-defense, but I understand your larger point, that you feel I didn't push the guest enough to talk about or account for her criminal past.
Well, that's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write to us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. As always, thanks, Christopher.
Thanks a lot, Farah.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.